Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silica Cast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, January 29th, 2012, and this is show number 350. Well, I got to tell you guys, Macworld was a total blast. I had so much fun. The vast majority of the Mac Roundtable crew was there, so it was a great time to meet up with old friends. You know, not everyone was there, which was bittersweet, but we managed to bear up. There were a lot of No Silica Cast listeners there, too, and it's just so fun to walk down the halls and keep running into somebody you know. The show was wonderful for more reasons than just friends. This year, they changed the pricing for the technical class tract. It used to cost a fortune. I don't know. I've heard numbers like $300 or $400. I've heard $1,200. Anyway, there was tons and tons of cost to it, so I never went to any of that. I would just go to the show floor. Now it's only $75 for the Tech Talks if you sign up early, $100 if you sign up late. All day long, I was stressed out because there were so many cool subjects I wanted to learn about, and I was stressed out because I couldn't find enough time to go to the show floor either. I think that's a great way to go, though. You don't want to get bored, right? You know, a listener, Zach, wrote in and said he knocked out the show floor in 3 hours, so he was disappointed. I think trying to go through that fast, though, you miss a lot of the little gems. Steve and I got a lot of great interviews and some really cool stuff for you, so I love the show floor, too. But I can see that if I had only the show floor to go to, it wouldn't have entertained me for days and days. Well, I guess we better talk about Blindfolded. I've got really mixed feelings about how it went. It was somewhere between a total success and an epic fail. Okay, I guess I better elaborate on that. The quick plot I planned was, here's how it was supposed to go. I was going to use the iPhone and text message Katie and ask her out to dinner. Then I was going to switch over to the Mac. From there, I was going to use Spotlight to launch Safari, navigate to Yelp, and search for an Italian restaurant in San Francisco. Once I found one I'd liked, I'd copy the address, and that was actually a really tricky part, but I still didn't have a problem with that. Then I'd launch iCal, create a new event for dinner with Katie, and I'd paste in the address from Yelp, set an alarm, and add Katie as an attendee and send her the message. Believe it or not, that's about 45 minutes right there. So that would be like, what, 30 seconds for a sighted person, but for a noob like me using VoiceOver, it takes a lot longer. Now, I chose this sequence of events because it exercised so many different commands, especially on the Mac side. It would require me to work with two different applications, interact with context, select buttons, copy content, and use pull-downs. So that's actually a whole lot of different kind of commands, where with you, for the sightlings amongst us, you just tap with your mouse and everything happens magically. When we practiced this all at home, Steve and I realized that the microphone would never pick up the sound of VoiceOver, especially on the iPhone. Our plan was to have the house mic in front of me in a stand, but also to have the mic that transmits directly to Steve's camcorder also right in front of me on a stand. The iPhone would have audio basically perpendicular to those mics, so it would be totally lost for the audience. Then we got the great idea to use Steve's Jawbone Jambox. I'd use an audio cable to connect it to the iPhone and then the Mac, and with its great booming sound, we'd be golden. We made sure it was charged, we brought two different audio cables in two different bags in case they got separated or lost, and we even brought a backup sort of cruddy speaker just in case something went wrong with the Jambox. When we got into the room, we realized that we could actually grab the audio jack for the house sound and just pipe that right into the iPhone and the iMac, bypassing entirely the need for that silly Jawbone we'd practiced with. That turned out to be great for the live audience, but it was a big mistake. We didn't realize until we came home and watched the video that Steve's camcorder was picking up me just great because I was on that mic we had there, but the house sound was very low on the recording. Now, we took a lot of good advice, and we did have our friend Wally Cherwinski do a second camera shoot. Turned out he actually was picking up the house sound. Not sure how this is going to come out in the end game, but it looks like Steve may be able to steal most of Wally's audio and splice it into our video and Wally's video combined. See, we want Wally's video, too, as a second camera shoot because he got really creative during the show. I had no idea he was doing this. He did warn me he might be walking behind me from time to time, but he was actually clambering all over the stage, shooting over my shoulder to get the iPhone. He was behind my back. He was way up in the air. He had the camera on some big stick. He was in the back of the room. That guy was everywhere. Well, for the sightlings in the audience, you'll enjoy being able to see what I'm doing. Anyway, let's talk about how the talk actually went. I started with some slides in Keynote, but I wasn't blindfolded for that part. I suppose I could have done it blindfolded, but I wouldn't know it was on the slides unless I bothered to memorize them, and then I'd have, or else I'd have to have them read to me, and that would be kind of lame. Memorization, not exactly my strong suit, so I decided not to do that. I'm also not wild about slides as a general rule, as you know, but there were a few points I wanted to make. I wanted to make sure that people knew why I was doing this. Part of it was for my own education, to force myself to learn it, you know, to stretch my brain. But more importantly, I wanted to point out how many blind people there actually are. There's 1.3 million legally blind people in the U.S. alone, and that there's a 70% unemployment rate amongst the blind. If more people were aware of how well sites can work that are well-designed and how well applications can run if developers just use the APIs that Apple puts right there in front of you, then that could get more people to realize how it can be done well. So, anyway, I made it through those slides without making any big goof-ups. After the slides, I plugged in my iPhone into the audio system and dramatically put on my blindfold. We couldn't figure out an easy way for people to see my phone screen, plus it would be problematic to show it on the big screen because, you know, other people's phone numbers might show as I did searching for Katie's. Now, for Katie, I used her Google Voice number. Just in case I tapped on her number, no one would get a real voicemail. When I first launched messages on the iPhone, it wasn't quite where I expected, but I was able to recover and successfully send her a message. Recovering from unexpected events was the main thing I worked on for the second half of my learning. It's all well and good if you can do it when nothing goes wrong, but what if something strange happens? The real trick is in recovering. I wasn't too worried about the iPhone because for me, it's a lot easier than the Mac. Okay, once I was done with the iPhone, all I had to do was unplug the audio and plug it into the Mac. That wasn't too tough. I managed to pull that off. I turned on VoiceOver on the Mac successfully. Then I used Spotlight to launch Safari. I muffed up a bit on getting to Yelp, but again, I did recover. I did a search for an Italian restaurant. I found one, and I copied the address. Boom, I'm golden. All I had to do next was launch iCal and do the invitation. iCal in general had never given me fits once I got the hang of it, so I figured I was home free after I was done with Safari because that's usually where I got hung up. So, remember how I said that Steve and I shouldn't have varied from our original plan on the audio? Well, I made another mistake. While I was practicing about a half hour before I went on stage, I had this brilliant idea to speed things up. I had put my blindfolded keynote file in Dropbox, but I thought, man, instead of having to open a Finder window and navigate to it before I started, I'd just drop a little copy on my desktop. There shouldn't be any harm in that, right? Okay, so I just finished with Safari. I quit Safari, which I think I didn't use to quit Safari. I think that might have been part of the mistake, too. But I thought that'd be cleaner for the viewing audience. I held down Command Spacebar to open Spotlight. I typed in iCal, but the nice voiceover lady did not say iCal when I typed it. And that's when things started to go horribly wrong. I have not yet figured out why this happened, but somehow that keynote file on my desktop got selected, and for the life of me, I couldn't get off of it. It was like I had something stuck to the bottom of my shoe, and I kept picking up, and I couldn't get it off. Now, the only reason I even knew I was stuck on it was that the audience had to start helping me. They explained to me that I was actually using Spotlight inside the keynote file, and it was trying to search for iCal inside my presentation. I thought, okay, all right, I can figure this out. I'll just open a Finder window, and that'd get me unstuck from that keynote file that kept sticking to the bottom of my foot. Well, that didn't work either. All I did then was launch Spotlight inside a Finder window. I started popping up pictures and all kinds of stuff. Evidently, I brought up a picture of myself, and Steve started getting really nervous that I might, you know, pop up a tax return or something on screen. Well, this went on for quite some time with the audience trying to help, and I have to say, sadly, that in the end, I had to pull off my blindfold. I had to kill VoiceOver, launch iCal, and put the headband back on. From there on out, it was smooth sailing. By some miracle, all that shenanigans, VoiceOver still had that address in the copy buffer, so I was able to paste it into the event. That was a small success that actually made me very happy. I finished up the invitation, and I hit send. Now, I said it was an epic fail because I did have to remove my headband, but I need to tell you that the audience reaction was exactly the opposite. They all told me afterwards that it very, very vividly illustrated how incredibly hard it is to learn and use VoiceOver, how hard it is to get unstuck without some sighted people to help out, and how you can still muddle through in the end. I was very pleased with their reactions to it. I thought they'd be throwing eggs at me or something for not having flawless execution. they felt that having the problems I had was actually a much better illustration for what must go on for the blind. Now, one question came up for in the Q&A at the end that I really did want to point out and ask you guys about. Mary Cahiao, wife of Victor Cahiao of the Typical Mac User, is a teacher, and she asked me whether there's any podcasts or good teaching programs online to teach people how to use VoiceOver. I told her that I didn't know of any, but that I'd throw it out there to you guys to find out. So if you know of any resources, I'd love to be able to get back to her with an answer. Now, I know you guys are all dying to see the video and watch my epic fail, or possibly incredible success, depending on your perspective. And Steve's going to have to put a lot of time into editing this particular video. Between his video and Wally's, he's got some creative editing time to enjoy. So hopefully it'll come out probably next weekend. I hope you do forgive the uneven audio we expect, but hey, you never know. Steve's a magician with that thing. I think you'll get the gist of the experiment. Like I said, I'm still ambivalent on whether it went well or not, but I do have to say I really appreciated something Don McAllister said during his QuickTime Tech Talk right after mine. Before he started, he told his audience that he figured his talk would be easy because at least he didn't have to wear a blindfold to do his. Well, let's dig in and do some demos from the show floor. You're about to hear the audio versions of the demos, but if you'd rather watch the videos, head on over to podfeet.com, and they should be up there in the next, probably in the next 24 hours, I think, depending on what time you're listening to this. I'm in the Avatron software booth with Elliot Chase. How are you doing today, Elliot?
I'm very well, thank you.
Oh, you're all fresh right now because the show just started, right?
Yeah, exactly. Give it a couple days.
You'll be all drippy at the end. But anyway, I came over here because I'm a big fan of Air Display, and I've talked about this on my show before, but why don't you tell people what Air Display is and then maybe walk me around the other tools?
Sure. Air Display is essentially a screen extension application for iOS devices. So you can take your iPad and turn it into a secondary display for your Mac or Windows, and just give yourself some extra screen real estate for your Twitter feed or your IM client or terminal or whatever you want to just move off to the side that you're not using right away.
I was waiting for a really important text message from somebody, but I didn't want to just sit there watching a tweet, and so I just took it and moved it over on my iPhone, and it worked perfectly.
Exactly. Works
just
really well.
Show them how it, just drag it back and forth there, show them.
So yeah, you can just take any window that's on your Mac screen and just move it back and forth. And we have like this drawing application over here right now, so you can use the touch input of the iPad to give you touch interface with OS X, which you wouldn't normally have.
That's actually OS X?
Yep, that's got OS X running essentially on your iPad as a secondary display.
Okay, cool. So you actually set this up, as I recall, like your display's preferences. You can just mess with it directly from there, right? Like the orientation?
Correct. As far as OS X is concerned, it's treats it just like a normal secondary display. You can change the side, you can mirror the two the screens together and show the same thing on both. And
cross-platform. Very cool. How much does Air Display cost?
It costs $9.99.
A steal.
Yeah.
Love it, love it.
Yeah, it's a great app. For.
Is it in the Mac App Store?
It is in the Mac App Store as well for taking your Mac, a secondary Mac you may have that's not doing anything, and turning it into a secondary
display.
It's
just Mac to Mac.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Hey, that's actually cool.
Yeah.
So what else you got here?
We have three other apps, well, two other apps, really. Air Sharing, Print Sharing, and Air Dictate. Air Dictate was pulled by Apple from the App Store about 3 days ago. They didn't really like the way we were hiding the keyboard and making our app kind of prettier. Instead of having to tap the little microphone button, we made it a little bit nicer. And they weren't really happy with us hiding the keyboard.
But you can probably get around that, fix it up, put it back.
We have some ideas about how to redo it and get it resubmitted, see if Apple lets us back into the store.
Okay, cool. So how about Air Sharing?
Air Sharing is actually the first application Avatron came out with in 2008. It's a document storage and viewing application. So it allows you to kind of treat your iPad or iPhone as the same way you would a thumb drive, just throw some files on it, but you can also view them or email them to someone or print them or connect to your Dropbox server and view files on your Dropbox server from there.
So when they're in Air Sharing, they're not actually, they actually live on that device?
You can access files that you've transferred from your computer locally to the device itself, or you can connect to your Dropbox server and access files remotely as well.
Okay, very cool. How about print sharing?
Print
sounds obvious.
Yeah, print sharing is essentially just the printing component of Air Sharing pulled out So people who just are looking for a way to print some files on their iOS device can just get print sharing just to print just a few files. It's very minimal. It doesn't really do a whole lot, but it just gives you the ability to print.
So does it give you the ability to print to printers that Apple doesn't already support?
Yes. It'll let you print to any printer that your Mac or Linux computer on the same network is sharing. So it doesn't matter what the printer is. Any printer that's being shared by your Mac, print sharing can print to.
I see. So how much is print sharing?
It's $2.99.
Ooh. Nice. How about air sharing?
Air sharing for the iPad is $9.99, and for the iPhone, it's $4.99.
Great. Very, very cool. Well, I like the simplicity and cleanliness of your apps. They're just real tight.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
they look great.
We spent a lot of time on the UI and trying to make them look as sharp and crisp as possible.
All right. Very cool. Thank you very much, Elliot, and good luck for your next 2 days.
Thank you.
I'm in the Night Eyes booth with Rick Case, and you've got some little products here that might look silly, but look like they solve some real problems.
Absolutely. So I'd like to tell you a little bit about what we have. This is a product of ours called Gear Tie, and Gear Tie it's a reusable rubber twist tie. So essentially, we've taken a low-carbon steel wire and extruded this thermoplastic rubber over the top of the wire, and it's a perfect way that you can twist, tie, bend them back and reuse these to organize things such as USB cables, charging cables, and any type of maybe headset cords. We make several different lengths, anywhere from the small 3-inch sizes up as large as something like 32-inch size. So you can go ahead and use these to bundle and secure many different types of items. The material is completely waterproof. They're UV resistant.
So for those that are just listening, this is a thick rubber cylinder, essentially, the way we're looking at it, with little rubber tips on the end.
Yes.
So you just basically twist it once. It's not like a twist tie where you wrap and wrap and wrap,
You can wrap and wrap and wrap.
But you don't have to.
No,
that's
you don't.
I like the idea of just going
really
around
just
once.
Depends. It makes it easy, especially on everybody's mobile phone charger. Just twist it around. It organizes the cord. When you're done, twist it back.
I love that. And they're very, very bright colors. They're yellow and green and orange and pink and, well, black, if you go that way. But the other thing that I, when he held up this this giant one, he shows he's got like a sleeping bag rolled on rolled up and held together, a hose, you know, a bunch of garden tools. It just, you get the feeling, okay, this is something big and bulky. I'm going to get out my 32-incher.
Sure, exactly. They're really great for tying things down. So instead of using bungee cords or maybe even using rope, gear ties are pretty fantastic for.
I hate bungee cords. I'm always fighting with that hook, and that thing's awful, you know.
Exactly. These are safe, and they also feel nice too. They're real comfortable.
Yeah.
On the material.
So, yeah, very cool.
So,
all right, let's work our way backwards here. We're going to go, I'm going to back into the room, see if I can clear a path walking backwards.
Okay, great.
Let's see.
Excuse me, Greg. I just want to talk about this here. So. Okay, so this is a new product we're very excited about that we just launched called the Connect Case. The Connect Case is an accessory for the iPhone 4 and the 4S. And essentially what we've created is a new polycarbonate case that's manufactured of Lexan, which is a shatterproof material. And the Connect Case has a removable clip on it. And what's nice about this case is that it's very easy to take your iPhone in and out of the case. We've invented this innovative flex hinge that allows you to easily take the phone in and out of the case, snap it shut, and now this has a nice diamond grip pattern, so it's comfortable. It's very low profile at the bottom, so you can still dock it in most of those areas. And it has a Connect port at the back, which allows you to go ahead and be able to attach different Connect accessories. And one of those that comes with the case is the Connect clip. And the Connect clip is also coming with another accessory that we make called the S-Beaner, which allows you to connect it to the clip. So if you want to attach it to a lanyard or be able to secure it to a backpack or to a strap, it's conveniently accessible. And our whole case is designed so that as you're going through your day with your iPhone, that it's practical and accessible to be able to keep up with it and keep it protected. There's a system of accessories that we've developed that go with the Connect case, and one of those is called the Connect Cradle. And the Connect Cradle essentially allows you to take your Connect case with your iPhone and be able to secure it in a place that would be conveniently accessible while you're on the go, for example, in your vehicle. So you can go ahead and connect the Connect Cradle, which uses gear tie technology, to go ahead.
You got it everywhere.
Exactly. They're fantastic. So now you can put it in a vent and be able to go ahead and connect the Kinect case right into it. So now you can power it, you can attach auxiliary cords to listen to music, but this is conveniently accessible so you can have visibility to it when you're on the go.
Now, what I've never liked about those is you always have to glop some junk on your car. So actually the ties, what are they called again?
These are called gear ties.
The gear ties are, again, the key element to that, to making it like you just pull it right off.
Exactly. And then you can remove this from a vehicle, for example, then take it into your home or to your office, and you can do a couple of things. You can use double-sided adhesive Velcro that we include with the package. So if you want to, I know, on the wall, that's fine. You can be able to use it, though. It's still nice to be able to power it. But you can also use this piece as a stand. And then
start making little balloon animals out of those eventually?
Absolutely, you can do that. The other thing that you can do with it is go ahead, we make an accessory called a mobile mount that allows you to secure the Kinect case to any type of bar.
So what he's showing right now in the video is he's showing it on a handlebar of a bicycle.
Exactly. So you can mount it either parallel to a bar or perpendicular to a bar. And it's very secure. And again, it's using gear tie technology, which allows you to attach it without using any tools. And this absorbs the shock as you're moving. So it's
an
easy way to be able to attach it and secure it.
Well, you've got some really interesting products here, and I like the gear ties as being the central element. It's a big tease, though, that you've got so many of them sitting there and won't sell them to us. Where can you get them?
You can buy these in several different locations. You get them on our website at niteize.com.
Spell that?
NITEIZE.com. And you can buy them from your favorite sporting goods retailers or hardware stores. So at REI, you can buy them. They're available on Amazon. Niteize manufactures almost over 300 different accessories, so we have a lot of innovation.
Very, very cool. Thank you for your time, Rick.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
I'm in the Parrot Solutions booth with Peter Jouse, and you've got a product I've never seen anything like this before. Why don't you tell us about it?
Hi there. Pete from Parrot Solutions. Our product charges and synchronizes 10 iPad devices. We have a similar product for iPods and iPhones that I'll show you in a moment. Let's start with the iPad solution. As I mentioned, charges and syncs all the devices. A light indicator shows you when it's charging, when it's syncing, and when it's fully charged. It comes with these 10 cases. Now, the case is keyed, you'll note, in such a way that I cannot misfire against that pin connector. That's a mechanical consideration in designing this product, to protect that pin connector from undue strain. So the whole system comes with 10 cases, the dock plus the 10 cases. It's a very nice price point at $1,000.
So then this just connects via USB to one Mac?
Connects to one Mac, absolutely. I'll show you over here with our iPod and iPhone system. This charges and syncs 20 devices at a time, and if you want to zoom in here on iTunes, you'll see how they all come up there in your iTunes library. Out of the box, there's no utilities that you need to install. You name, you register each device as you normally would to your account, and it'll sync them all up. It takes about 20 minutes to sync a gig of content to all 20 devices, and 30 minutes to sync 2 gigs of content.
Wow, that is really slick. Now, this, you don't need to have those special carriers for these?
No, we have a slotted system. So you'll note that the slot is cut specific to the profile of the iOS device. So we do have a unique insert for every iPod model or iPhone model that would require a slotted system.
So you can mix and match iPhones and iPods in the same unit?
No, this is designed for homogeneous infrastructure. Remember, most of our users are schools, healthcare providers, hospitals, museums. They're dealing with a homogeneous infrastructure. They don't have a lot of mixing and matching going on.
Well, plus, the whole purpose of this is I got to get a lot of these done at once. It's not like you're going to do this day to day, right? You're more likely this is in a deployment phase.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a daily operation in terms of keeping them charged. For example,
for schools,
schools, for museums, they have a high turnover of visitors. They got to constantly have a freshly charged device at the ready for that visitor. So, yeah, I mean, they're going to be using this a lot during the course of the day. Now, in terms of syncing, that might be something that they do on a periodic basis as their exhibit changes, as educational content needs change as well.
Right, but the charging is always there, that's
always,
for sure.
It's always
so how
there.
Much is the...
This is $980.
Only $20 off, and it doesn't have those little carriers?
That's right.
That's a steal at half the price, right? All right, thank you very much for your time, Pete.
Thank you. If you want to check it out, we're on parrotsolutions.com, P-A-R-A-T, solutions.com.
Great, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm in the POWIS booth right now with Susie Ekman, and she is the COO of this company. And you guys had a really interesting tagline in your press release that caught me. Right. What was it? What's your favorite position?
Yeah, what's your favorite position? So we sell the POWISite case. And the main selling point of our iPad case is that it has 9 different positions, so you can use it for reading on the airplane, reading in bed, you can use it for watching movies. So,
okay, show us what it can do.
Yeah. So we've got that position, which is great for the airplanes. You can flip it over, get it from that angle. You can also watch it vertically like this. You can set it here. We've got rubber edge guards here that make it stick to even the slickest surfaces.
Nice. So turn it around and show the camera the mechanism in the back.
Yep. So it's a stand. And it basically, the shape allows you to move it into all those different positions.
Okay. Play with it nicely.
Yeah.
It feels really nice. It feels really secure.
It is. So we manufacture the product in Berkeley.
Oh, you do?
Across the bridge.
Made in America, huh?
It is made in America.
I love it. And you've got some really good-looking different covers here.
Right. So we are able to take a photograph and put it on the cover.
So you custom make them.
We can, yeah. So we turn these around in a week, and again, we do that in Berkeley. So we can take a photo of anything.
So design your own. It says $79.95. What about stock versions?
The stock versions, like this one, are $59.95, and this is a premium cloth. We also sell our leather ones for $59.95. The premium leather, which is a textured leather, we sell this, and alligator leather. These are $79.95.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Susie. This is a cool-looking product.
You're welcome.
All right, well, that's enough product demos from Macworld for this week, but we have lots more that we'll be giving over the next few weeks, and remember to go over and check out the videos at podfeet.com as well.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions.
Dumb questions.
What do I? What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Well, Steve Davidson brings us our dumb question for the week. A couple of months ago, 'twas the season when I generate a passel of sticky-based address labels in order to send family, friends, past colleagues, and other assorted people my wife and I have collected over the years our family's annual report. You know, the typical holiday card featuring a photo of my kids and dog, accompanied by a one-page note packed with photos and stories about the year just ending. Before I migrated to Lion, I'd been using the Palm desktop application to manage my address book and print the annual address labels. The Palm desktop is a PowerPC application, and as is was Eudora, so these two applications are no longer an option for me. As astute listeners of the NoSilicast know, I now use Apple Mail. And as a consequence, I also use Apple's address book to manage my contacts. There are around 150 recipients of our annual report, and for some I have a home address, for others I have a work address, and for many slash most, I have both addresses. My algorithm for printing labels was, if exists home, then use it, otherwise use work. With Palm Desktop's Excel-like view, I sorted them on home street address, selected those that had had entries in that column, and printed the selected set, specifying a label template that printed home address. Then I would select the remainder, print that set, specifying a label template that printed work address. Now I'm using Apple's address book, which lacks much of the functionality of the Palm Desktop, and this year I ended up producing nearly 1.5 times as many address labels as I needed to, which was wasteful and required sifting through the printed output to remove the redundant labels, which was not without the commission of errors. So the dumb question is there any way to recreate the capabilities I gave up when I migrated from the Palm Desktop to Apple's address book? And if not, can you recommend a better alternative for the purpose of producing these labels? All right, this question baffled me completely at first, especially since it hadn't been a problem for me. I never got the doubling up of labels. I wasn't sure I'd even be able to think of a fix. Completely unrelated, though, a buddy of mine happened to mention how much he hates using word merge from a CSV file of an address book to make labels for Christmas cards. I remember those good old days. What a nightmare that was. So I whipped out my Mac and I showed him how in Apple's address book, all you have to do is create a group, add names to it, select all, go to print, and one of the options is address label. He was amazed and delighted, as I was the first time I figured it out. Well, I bring this whole story up because while I was showing him, I noticed that there's a field in the print menu that said addresses and that it had a pulldown that was currently set to all. I clicked it, and lo and behold, if you click that, you can choose home, work, or other. I thought that the best way to make sure there was no confusion on how to do this for Steve was that if I whipped open Clarify from BlueMangoLearning.com, took 5 quick screenshots, threw in a couple of annotations, clicked the share button, and I was rewarded with a link I could drop into the email back to Steve. Now, I didn't start this dumb question with the intention of making it into an ad for Clarify, but Steve's response back sort of made me do it. He wrote, "Incidentally, you are a great advertisement for Clarify. The visual was excellent." So I didn't completely answer Steve's question with this. This was simply a way to choose home or work, but I suppose you could make two separate groups within address book, one for home people and one who have work addresses, and just drop them into the different ones and then print them out. A little bit of extra work there. In any case, Steve is happy. I was able to sneakily trick you into learning about using Clarify and another great use for it. If you haven't checked it out yet, go to BlueMangoLearning.com for a free trial, or you can go straight to the link in the show notes for Clarify in the Mac App Store and just buy it. Well, I did want to make one more quick mention of how much fun the Nocilla Castaways party was at Macworld. We had a much better room at Jillian's this year, complete with a pool table. I really enjoyed spending time with the other members of our crew, and most of the Mac Roundtable was on board for the party as well. I can't mention names because you know I'll forget someone, so I won't be able to do it, but you know who you are, and you know how much fun it was to hang out. Speaking of hanging out, we did a Google Hangout with people who couldn't come to the party. It was a great success. Well, okay, not at first. We set up Steve's MacBook Air on a table a bit out of the way so people could knock it about, and we used the Samson Meteor mic I told you about a couple weeks ago and a pair of headphones. That way the partygoers and the hangouters could actually hear each other. We'd had trouble the years before where we'd kind of just drag the Mac around and had people talking to it. Nobody could hear anybody. It was all basically people just waving at faces and not very interactive. So we set this up on a separate table, and we had my MiFi set up so we knew the network and understood what it could do. But we had a bit of a hiccup when we were unable to actually keep a hangout going. We could open it, but as soon as somebody joined, I think Timothy McGuire joined, as soon as we did it, it would crash out of it. So it is still a bit buggy. Luckily, Kevin Alder did get it going on his end, so we just tweeted out to have people join his Google Hangout. It was so much more fun for those on Google Plus because when there was no one at the party to talk to them, they still had their own little party. They didn't get much peace and quiet, though. There was a constant stream of people joining them. On the Hangout, we had Kevin, of course, Donald Burr, Michelle Lopez, Timothy Gregoire, Mike McPhee, Carell Harrison, and Alistair Jenks. It was international. People all over the globe came to the party, so it was really, really fun. I think a big moment for everyone on the call might have been when Rod Roddenberry joined them, and Donald did Live Long and Prosper, and Rod immediately did it right back at him. It was hilarious. Rod's such a great guy. He loves the Geek Fest as much as anyone. In fact, he spent most of the trip convincing everybody to start using a service called Voxer, V-O-X-E-R, on their iPhones. It's sort of a walkie-talkie system, sort of like Heytel, except it also allows you to do text and pictures, and you can do groups as well. And he went around just telling every person, you have to get on Voxer, you have to get on Voxer. So we've all been yapping each other on Voxer now. It's really, really fun. So anyway, I posted a Flickr set of the party, of the Nocilla Castaways party, and most of the pictures are mine, but some of the best ones are actually from Kirshen. I put a link to the Flickr set in the show notes. Mark Pooley, also known as Switcher Mark, also posted a set of just the Google Hangout. It's kind of cool to get that perspective. You can see how much fun everyone is having and playing with in the Hangout. So check out that Flickr link in the show notes as well. Anyway, a good time was had by all. While we were at Macworld, I was listening to Dave Hamilton and John F. Braun on stage for a live Mac Geek Gab. Someone had a problem when they rebuilt a system. Dave speculated that they had a problem in ownership of the files and explained that you have to have the right account actually own the files. He went on to explain that you can change the ownership of the files in question by using the Unix command C-H-O-W-N. I don't know if you pronounce it chown or change owner or how you say it, but anyway, it's C-H-O-W-N. He popped up in a terminal window and he typed in the command, making sure he put in super user do at the beginning, and he wanted everyone to see exactly what the command looked like. I remember thinking to myself, though, wow, that's sure a slow way to do it. Now, I said that because, of course, I have a text expander snippet for it. When I put my solid state drive into my MacBook Pro, I had the same problem as this guy asking the question, and it was exacerbated by that because in my ignorance, I thought it was a really good idea to keep my original account of the exact same name on my spindle hard drive. OS X was constantly getting confused, and I had to keep explaining to it which Allison it was supposed to be giving control of things. So, all right, that's not exactly an ideal condition, but it is an ideal condition to use text expander. I simply type ch semicolon and outbang sudo chown space dash capital R Allison space tilde Allison slash. Three characters displacing 32, not a bad trade-off at all. If you'd like to have text expander at your fingertips to make it really fast to type out things you need all the time, head on over to the Mac App Store to buy it once for all your Macs. If you'd like to check out the free trial first, head on over to smilesoftware.com and be sure to tell them that Allison sent you. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchotts. Lovely to be talking to you this week, Bart.
And likewise, Allison. I hope you had fun over in Macworld.
Oh, yeah, it was a great blast, but fun to have you 2 weeks in a row. I guess we're going to try to get back on schedule so you're with me every other week and IMP with every other week.
Yeah, with the whole Christmas thing, everything got completely out of whack. So I ended up with you and IMP on the same week every second week. So it was like one weekend of no podcasting and then one weekend of two. So I'm trying to rebalance.
I blame the 12 hours of podcasting. That's got to have thrown every schedule off, right?
Right. Yeah, without a shadow of a doubt.
All right. Well, we got a lot to talk about. I don't see any security light on the agenda today, though.
That's because there doesn't seem to be any, which always makes me worried and suspicious. But there doesn't seem to be any. So unless something really dramatic happens between now and when the show goes out, I think we're good on that count.
Oh, great. So we have nothing to worry about in security?
No, unfortunately, not quite. We do have a security medium, which may even be a security well done, depending on whether you do security like steak. This is one that's been around for a week or so, and I didn't want to talk about it until I was sure I had everything straight in my head and all of my ducks in a row. But they're all lined up now, so it's time to talk about it. So all of this revolves around a protocol called WPS, which stands for Wi-Fi Protected Setup. And this was a protocol developed by the Wi-Fi Alliance with the intention of trying to square the circle and make Wi-Fi both convenient and secure. You know the standard trade-off is you can either have something that's easy or something that's secure. You can rarely have both. And they were hoping to get around that. And so this is a PIN-based system. So instead of entering a big, long password, you would just enter a PIN that was provided by the router into the device that you're trying to associate, and then they would do a whole bunch of horribly complex cryptography, and the end result would be that the device would be securely on your WPA2 network.
Okay. So that sounds good.
Yeah, it sounds very good. So instead of having to type in Bart's horrible long 63-character password when you visited Ireland a few years ago, you would just type in a 4-digit PIN, or an 8-digit PIN, and then you'd be done. The system was initially designed to work off a randomly generated PIN. So each time you went to associate, the PIN would be different. So the process would be hit some sort of button to say make a PIN, read the PIN, type the PIN in on the device, done. But it will be a different PIN every time. But to make that work, and that is how lots of things work. I mean, iTunes, I think it's when iTunes associates with an iTunes remote, it does that. When Keynote associates with a Keynote remote, it uses that technique. It's quite common. I think Bluetooth pairing, again, uses the idea of passing a PIN over and back. So it's a common idea.
Yeah, I've seen it there, definitely.
Yeah. So for this to work, it would require that routers spend a little bit more money on hardware and install a 4-character LCD display onto each router so that you could read the PIN number off. And that was too much for the router manufacturers to swallow. I was like, yeah, yeah, we want security, but god damn, we're not putting a screen in our devices. That'll make them, like, you know, 5 cents more expensive. So they hummed and they basically pushed back hard. And a compromise was reached. And so instead of it being a randomly generated pin, the pin was hard-coded into the router and written onto the bottom of the router on a sticker. So
I don't know quite where we're going to go with this, but I've always figured if there's someone in your house that can read a sticker on your router, that then you've got bigger problems.
Absolutely. The fact that it's on a sticker isn't the problem. The fact that it is set in stone and can never be changed ever is certainly part of the problem. But there's an even bigger problem, which you will come to in a moment. So they did make one small concession to security when they did this. They doubled the pin from 4 to 8. Only they didn't really double it, because they decided to make the last bit a checksum, so that your device could tell you that we were definitely wrong without even checking with the router. So it's another way. I think it's the same on credit card numbers. I think that the last digit is actually a checksum, and so you can tell if a credit card is invalid without ever going to the bank. So there's actually only 7 bits there, 7 digits of information. So that's not a lot to prevent brute forcing. So the specification also says that you should have a sort of a timeout where if you fail 3 times in a row, you get locked out for a certain amount of time, and that should slow down brute force attacks. The other thing to say then is, in order to get the Wi-Fi certified sticker on your router, it is compulsory that you support this protocol, and not only that you support it, but that it be turned on by default. So lots and lots and lots of people...
That sounds like a good thing.
If it were a well-built protocol, yeah, sure. It's not, though.
Okay.
So this is a problem a lot of people have, because WPS is on because they have never turned it off. So what is the problem? The first thing to say is, if you have a router with a variable pin that changes every time, there is no problem. The problem only exists in devices that went for the write the pin down on the bottom of the router model instead of having the pin change every time. So the static pins are where the problem lies. And to be perfectly honest, the entire concept of a static pin is fundamentally flawed, because it means that people have the age of the universe effectively to brute force your connection. And if you ever give anyone the pin once, they will have the unchangeable pin forever and ever and ever. So if you... So that's not good. An unchangeable short password is what it effectively boils down to, with infinitely large amounts of time for attack. So that's a fundamental problem with the whole concept. So as far as I'm concerned, they should never have made it beyond the drawing board. They should have put their foot down. And from what I was listening to on various podcasts, apparently the cryptographers wrote very strongly worded letters to the Wi-Fi Alliance saying that, cryptographically speaking, the static pin option is not an option, and they were ignored because it would have cost a few extra cents to put in the LCD display. So in my mind, there's a sniff of scandal off of this. But we'll leave that aside. We won't look at that. So it's a fundamentally flawed idea anyway, but not only is it flawed in that regard, they just made a complete mess of it in other ways too. So the first thing is that the 7-digit pin was a hack added on afterwards, because the whole protocol is designed around these 4-digit randomly generated pins. So the way that the multi-digit pin works is that you verify the first 4 digits and then you verify the second 4 digits. Now, if you do the math on...
Oh, instead of verifying 8.
Yeah.
Verifying 4 and 4 is not the same as verifying 8.
Not by a factor of a few hundred thousand. Yeah, it's like, cryptographically speaking, that's one of those ones where, you know, it's 4 choose 1 or whatever that NC, whatever that, I can't remember, I wish I'd done maths more recently, but if you work it out, the probability, you know, the amount of work you have to do to break 4 is not half the amount of work you have to do to break 8. So doing 4 twice versus doing 8 is completely different.
Right, it's not half, it's, yeah, a whole bigger number.
Yeah.
That's our mathematical explanation.
Well, we're dealing with digits from 0 to 9 here. So every time you add a digit, you multiply by 10 the amount of work you have to do. So to go from 4 to 8, you multiply by 10 by 10 by 10 by 10, so 10,000. So it's 10,000 times harder to do 8 than 10, whereas it's twice as hard to do 4 than 4. Sorry, to do 4 and 8 is a factor of 10,000. To do 4 and then 4 again is a factor of 2. Not the same thing. So that's a pretty big flaw. And in fact, because the last four digits has the checksum on the end, it's brute force 4, then brute force 3. So the hardest thing you have to do is brute force the 4, which isn't very hard anyway. Then the other massive point of failure is that there's supposed to be a timeout if you get it wrong too many times. Quite a few router manufacturers didn't bother with that. So there is no timeout.
That was inconvenient.
Yeah. So you don't have to brute force nearly as often as you should, and you don't have to wait between your attempts, because there is no lockout for some routers that don't obey that bit of the protocol. So in reality, there are some routers that people are reporting getting into in a matter of a few minutes. And once they have the pin, they have it forever and ever and ever, and you can't take the pin off the router. So that's not good.
So let me ask a stupid question. Where is this person who, let's say I've been hacked, they've got my pin. Where are they? Are they in my neighborhood? Are they in Russia?
They would have to be within Wi-Fi range to collect the information. Like, they have to be able to see your Wi-Fi access point to be able to authenticate to it. I mean, it's someone trying to steal your internet.
Okay.
So they have to be able to see your internet to steal them. Things get even worse, though. As if all that isn't bad enough. There's also a slight flaw in that if you watch the traffic, which you can do, because there is no security yet. The whole point of this protocol is the protocol establishes the encryption. So there is no encryption. So anyone can watch the setup procedure. And if you just capture those packets, take them with you and go home, you can do all the brute forcing on the captured packets in what's called an offline attack. So there won't be any sign that someone's trying to hack your router. You won't see loads of failed login attempts or anything like that, because not a single packet will be sent to the router. They'll just be watching your router when you associate a device, take the information, go home with it, use that information to work out your PIN at their leisure, and then come back and successfully authenticate first try. So if you're looking at your logs, you won't see any suspicious activity at all. And
so this has been true for ages, right?
Yes, well, we hadn't had the tools, like so many things. The vulnerabilities have been there since the design of the protocol, but no one's discovered them until recently. So it was December 2011 is when all this came out.
There
was a paper released, and there's a tool has been released, so you can actually download a free and open source tool that will just do it. It's called Reaver. And you just basically install Reaver, which you can download off, I think it's on SourceForge or Google Code or one of those open places. Download it, run it, and break into people's Wi-Fi. So, even if you have one of those routers that obeys the rules and does do the timeout, if you do an offline attack, timeouts don't matter because there's nothing being sent to the router each time. So this is not good. So, and because there's a free open source tool, the skill level required by the attacker is basically very, very low. Can you run some software? Yes? Okay, then you can steal all your neighbor's Wi-Fi. So, you know, the kid next door is perfectly capable of doing this. This is not the kind of, you know, you're not talking CIA level elite hacker here. You're talking about any idiot can do this. So that's all very bad. So that leads to the very obvious question, how the hell do we protect ourselves from this? And the answer is quite simple.
Right, but since you didn't say it was security light.
Oh no, there is an answer, but the answer varies depending on who made your router. And for some people, the answer is, don't worry your pretty head about it. And for other people, the answer is, buy a new router. And there's a whole spectrum in between.
Oh, wow.
So, the simple answer, how do you stop this problem, is you disable WPS. There is no way to fix WPS, you just got to make it go away. And that is how you deal. That is the only workaround to this problem, is don't allow WPS to work on your router. Now, if you have a router that does not have a static PIN, but actually gives you a different PIN every time, then there is no vulnerability whatsoever. Therefore, if you have an Apple router, you have no problems. Because Apple use a variable PIN. And in fact, the way Apple do it is they don't have a screen on the router.
Oh, so they could have chosen?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
This is why it has a whole hint of scandal to it, right? Because Apple have routers that support WPS and don't have this vulnerability. And they didn't waste money on an LCD display on the router. What they did was they built it into the airport utility. So you go into the airport utility, you choose add device, and it asks you, how would you like to add this device? And one of the options basically is to do WPS. and it will give you a randomly generated PIN inside the interface of the Apple Airport utility. You type that into your device, hey presto, all is well. WPS is actually only enabled while you're using Airport Utility. So there's no vulnerability at all unless you go into your router, or sorry, you launch Airport Utility, connect to the router, and say, I'd now want to add a device, and then WPS starts up. So Apple have done it right. So if you have an airport anything, no problemo. Just continue on with life. You are fine. Wow. Unfortunately, I don't know of a single other make of router that does it right. So if you don't have an Apple router, your only other chance of being safe is to have a very old router. Because this hasn't been compulsory forever. Therefore, if you have an old router, the chances are no one bothered with it. So if your router's old enough...
What about doing something like putting the tomato router... router? Sorry, you say router, we say router, so now I'm mixing them together. Putting the tomato firmware change onto a Linksys router.
That would work.
They could fix...
Yes,
or because if tomato has fixed it. But that would happen faster than Linksys.
Exactly. So Tomato and DDWRT and many of these various open source free router OSs allow you to turn off WPS, and that's your goal. It doesn't matter whether they support it. What matters is whether they support turning it off. Now, you mentioned Linksys. Linksys are the inverse of Apple for the purpose of this discussion. So Apple users have nothing to worry about. Linksys users are in the worst of all possible worlds. The Linksys router's interface has a button called Turn Off WPS. That button does nothing.
Yeah.
It is there purely for your visual entertainment. It doesn't actually turn it off. The router continues to listen to WPS and continues to be hackable by this flaw. Which I think is priceless. That's just... Oy, that's as bad as it gets.
That's like as mean as you could be.
Yeah, basically the two worst brands of router to have are Linksys and Cisco. Because, of course, Cisco own Linksys, so that's not entirely surprising. So, if you have a Cisco, you're lucky...
Hey, I'm going to make a public service announcement right... Yeah. Bart, I'm going to make a public service announcement right now. If the listeners have noticed that Bart and I are stepping on each other, we're having a killer Skype lag right now. We've disconnected and reconnected, but rather than keeping doing that, we're going to keep going. But we're not just being rude to each other. Just end of the announcement.
And it seems to be growing because it was okay at the start of this call. But now
it's getting worse.
Yeah. Anyway, so Cisco and Linksys are at the bottom of the pile here. You can install Tomato or Tomato. So Tomato Router or Tomato Router. God, there's a lot of permutations there, but you can install that. Or you can, if you bought the router recently, go back to wherever you bought it and demand your money back because they sold you a fundamentally flawed product. And
I can't picture successfully explaining that at Best Buy, though, or Amazon or any place to say, well, because of the flaw in this technology. But
the fact that the button does nothing is a pretty big flaw.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's physically impossible to protect yourself because of, quite frankly, Cisco's incompetence, that's kind of a big deal. So I would be inclined to say... that you do have a case. You may have to argue your point strongly, and you'll probably have to talk to a manager. But I wouldn't go home too easy if I were in that boat, because I would feel very hard done by. And I think in Europe, we have quite strong consumer protections. The chances are, if you were to contact your European Member of Parliament, they might be able to point you at some relevant laws you could cite. It's always good to be able to give chapter and verse. According to the Blah de Blah Act of Blah Year, paragraph 4, subsection 2, it's always nice to be able to say that. So basically,
I'm about to enact something like that with my little friends over at Sony. I can tell it just a quick little interlude. They sold me a DVD that says it's got a free digital copy inside, but the free digital copy has expired. And as compensation for that, they offered to. And the movie I bought was District 9. They've told me that instead I can have the Smurfs.
They're just the same as each other.
Not exactly what I was looking for, but I Right. I believe there are some bait and switch laws, at least in the state of California, that I could cite to have a little stronger discussion with him. But anyway, that was a side lobe there. Okay, so we've got the wrong kind of router. We should take it back, or if we don't try to root it.
Yeah,
root your router.
If you feel that you have the technical skills. And you want to give it a go, install Tomato or one of the many. I've actually included a link in the show notes to a Wikipedia page listing all the different free and open source firmware. So there's lots there to choose from. If you take one that isn't one of the famous ones like DDWRT or Tomato, be sure that that firmware isn't also vulnerable to this flaw, and be sure that your router is supported by that firmware. The other thing to say, you're kind of in a no-lose situation because before you start, you're in a situation that you have an unsecurable router, so you got to go out to the shop and buy a new one anyway. So if you fry it into a million pieces, you're in no different situation than when you started.
Right, exactly.
Or you could wait for Cisco to release an update, which I guess they will do, but depending on how old your router is, will the update be for you or will it only be for newer models? Kind of gambling a bit there. Good news. So Belkin, D-Link, Netgear, and TP-Link are all vulnerable, but they all have a button in their interface to turn off WPS, and unlike Linksys, the button actually does what it's supposed to. So if you have one of those four brands of routers,
oh, that's good.
You have to take the time to log into your router and turn off WPS, but once you've done that, you're fine, and then you can carry on with life. If your router isn't Cisco, Apple, D-Link, Netgear, Belkin or TP-Link, there is a link in the show notes to a spreadsheet which was linked to by US Cert, and therefore I trust it because it's on Google Docs, so you don't really know who wrote it, but US Cert trusted, so I'm going to trust it. And it lists 137 at this moment different makes and model of router and how vulnerable they are to this. And so with the exception of the Apple ones, they pretty much all say yes, they are vulnerable, but then there's another column that says can you turn it off, and then there's another column that says if you turn it off, is it really off? And so you can just read across the columns and see where you stand. I particularly love the idea of,
wow,
you know, a button.
That is absolutely crazy.
So, take home message. You have an Apple router, you're done.
All right.
Oh, sorry, Allison.
No, go ahead.
God, I hate lag. So I was going to say a quick summary. So if you have an Apple router, you're fine. If you have a Linksys router, you're in deep trouble. Any other router, the chances are you log into your interface, you turn it off, you're good. And so once WPS is off, the problem just goes away.
All right. Well, now that we've eaten some rather giant vegetables, I'm going to suggest that we stop and start the recording again, if it's okay with you, Bart.
Oh, yeah, that sounds like a plan.
And we're back after disconnecting Skype and reconnecting to see if we can have a better conversation for the funner half of the conversation today.
Well, I thought, given how ick that was, especially for anyone who's unfortunate to have a Linksys router, I've ruined your day. So I thought we'd talk about something more fun. And whenever I want to do that, I always run home to photography.
Yay!
So I think I mentioned when we were talking about the Nikon D5100 that I tested it out in low light, or maybe I hadn't, but anyway, it doesn't matter. To test a camera out in low light, there's nothing like going out at night and pointing it at the stars and see if anything comes out, because that's about as low a light as you usually run into. Even
right.
Sunsets aren't as dark as night. So I did that, and I got some nice results, and as I was posting them to Flickr, I was getting a lot of comments back from people and a lot of questions, so I thought it would be worth consolidating sort of my answers into a blog post, which is linked in the show notes, and perhaps having a little chat about it with Allison. So here we are.
And your success was just phenomenal. So that's what's even better.
Yes. Well, thank you. So the first thing to say is I want to set expectations here. You can get really nice results as long as you don't push the envelope and go into sort of expect the impossible, right? If you think you're going to get like a Hubble Space Telescope quality image where you're zoomed the whole way into a galaxy and you can count the stars, not going to happen. if you have a realistic expectation of basically seeing a large chunk of the sky at about the same amount of zoom as you see it with your eye, then you're golden. So think of shooting constellations, not shooting galaxies, and then you're fine. And you can get really quite pleasant results without having to spend the fortune on equipment. Ultimately, the reason that you need a lot of equipment to do good astronomy work is because the stars won't bloody well stand still. Or, to be more precise, the Earth won't bloody well stand still, because as we rotate, stars rise and set, rise and set, rise and set. So anytime you try to, you know, if you think about it, when something's dark, you just, you know, you expose a bit longer and it'll be fine. But in the case of the stars, you expose a bit longer and they've buggered off. Well, they just keep moving, and the more you zoom in, the quicker they move across your screen, to the point that if you really zoom in a lot with a telescope, it'll go from one end of the screen to the other in a matter of 2 or 3 seconds.
Wow.
And there really isn't a lot of light there, so that's not good. So if you want to do this and get really pro shots, what you need is a mount that will follow the stars, and therefore you can get your long exposure. But then you run into the fact that CCDs get awfully noisy when you leave them exposing for a long time, and so then you have to do fancy techniques, and then you need fancy software. So basically, to get the zoomed-in images, you need a lot of equipment, you need a lot of skill, you need a lot of software, you need a lot of time, and a lot of persistence. I have none of those things. So, with three things, basically, you can get fun star shots as long as you don't expect to be getting the Hubble Space Telescope images. So what you need is a camera which allows you to do the following things. You have to be able to manually set the aperture, the shutter speed, the ISO, and the white balance. And you need to be sure that you can set, you can leave the exposure go for up to 30 seconds. So if your camera won't go for more than a second, you're in trouble. But most cameras will let you go up to 30. Or if they let you go into a bulb mode, then you can do the counting instead of the camera, and then you're still golden. And then the other thing is there has to be an ability to manually focus in some way, or at least to lock in focus when you get it. So they're the only requirements on the camera.
Okay.
The other thing you will need is a tripod.
That seems
no real requirements
rather essential.
Yeah. So the only requirement on the tripod is that it's strong enough to hold up your camera. That's it. And then the last thing you need, which is optional, you can work around it, but the last thing you ideally want is some sort of remote shutter release, either an old-fashioned one with a cable or one of these newfangled infrared ones. If you don't have one of those, don't panic. A, they're not expensive if you want to go out and pick one up. You picked one up recently for, what was it?
I don't remember.
It's not that much, is it?
Not much. Tens of dollars.
I think mine was $29 when I bought it a few years ago. If you don't have one, don't panic. There is a workaround for this. The reason that you want to use the shutter release, a remote one, is so you don't shake the camera, because then you'll add shake into all of your stars. The other way around that is to use the mode where your camera, you hit the button and the camera waits a few seconds and then takes the picture.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So that's designed for taking a group photo. So you hit the button, you run in, you try not to look like you just run in and try to smile, and then it goes click and it doesn't work. That's what it's normally used for. But if you do it on a tripod, then any vibration you put in by hitting the button will have dissipated before the camera actually fires. Problem solved. So that's your workaround. The annoying thing about the workaround is that you're wasting, you know, you're taking a lot of shots and trial and error to get stuff right, and each time you're waiting 5 seconds and But anyway. So that's all you need for equipment.
Okay.
So
I think I have
to
all
get
of that.
Set up.
Well, how big of a zoom do you need?
Oh, as small as possible, actually.
Oh.
As in, you don't want to zoom in, because every bit of zooming you do makes the stars go faster. And not only does it make the stars go faster, it makes the light dimmer. The more you zoom in, the dimmer an image gets, because you're stretching the same amount of light over a bigger area. So it gets dimmer. So zooming in kills you twice. It kills you because there's less light coming into the lens, and it kills you again because the stars are moving quicker, so you can't expose as long. So zooming is bad. So really what you want is wide open, wide angle lens, 18mm kind of job, perfect. 30mm is still tolerable, but you don't really want to be zooming in too much.
Huh. Okay.
So this is why I say we're not getting close-up shots. We're getting the big picture here.
Okay.
And that means that you have less motion and more light. So you start off, you know, screw your camera to your tripod, pick your widest lens, set your aperture wide open. So, you know, this is actually where our 30mm primes come in really nice. Because they go to f1.4. And f1.4 is very bright.
Okay.
So you get lots and lots of light in with an f1.4 lens. So if you have a nifty-50 will work nicely here. Even though it's not the widest lens around, it's nice and bright because they're going to be at least an f1.8, maybe even a 1.4. So that's good. But if not, I mean, I do a lot of my stuff with the standard zoom lens that comes with the Nikon D40, and the one that comes with the D5100 is the same lens but with VR added in, so it's 18 to 55 millimeters, f3.5 to 5.6. So you stick it to 18, and you stick you turn the f-stop down as far as it'll go, which is 3.5, and away you go.
Okay.
The next thing you have to remember to do is set the white balance to daylight. Your camera will get unbelievably confused in the middle of the night when there's almost no light, and it's trying to figure out auto white balance. It's going to tie itself in all sorts of knots.
Okay, but you pick daylight.
Yeah, because the stars are suns.
I suppose.
Moonlight is sunlight reflected.
Yeah, I'd have to give you that one.
So, yeah, so it is right. It gives you natural, quote-unquote, colour. So that's what all the advice I've ever read says, and it works for me. So.
Huh. Okay, I would not have thought
that. The other thing I would say, and I forgot to put it into my blog post, I'll have to edit that, is if you can, shoot raw. You don't have to, but it just makes life a bit easier. It gives you that little bit more of a buffer if you don't get it quite right. And you also want to set the ISO to something that's, you know, you want to manually set it or it's going to race off as high as it can go, and you don't really want that because it'll get horribly noisy. So when I'm setting up, I like to start about ISO 200 where I know it's clean. And then we're going to ramp it up as we go, but start off with it on a decent setting. So ISO 200 or so and work from there. Then just hit the whatever button on your camera, dig into the menus to make your remote shutter release actually work, or set it up for the delayed shutter, whichever is appropriate. And then you kind of hit the hard part, which is getting everything in focus.
Okay.
Your success here will vary with practice and with your camera's autofocus system. So all the stars, everything up in the sky, is effectively at infinite focus. So this is actually one of those rare situations where having a ye olde lens that isn't in any way motorized or electronicized or in any way, you know, you can't meter with it, you can't autofocus with it. That's actually a good thing, because those old lenses have little numbers written on the side of them to tell you how many feet away from you you're focused. And there'll be an infinity symbol somewhere and a white line pointing at where that focus is. And
I'm so with an old lens, you would be a dial good it one to infinity. Okay.
Yeah, so you just dial it to infinity and off you go. Unfortunately, these modern newfangled electronic lenses we all have don't have anything written on the barrel. Like, I don't know about you, but I have never had a lens for my DSLR.
Hang on. I'm five feet from mine, but I'm pretty sure it does. Hang on.
Okay.
Because I remember looking for that when I was trying to do the... I'm a liar.
It says how many millimeters you're zooming to, doesn't it?
Sure it does. I could have sworn it did. Well, I hallucinated it. I remember seeing a little infinity symbol, but maybe that was way, way, way back when.
It was certainly always on old lenses. Actually, one place you might have seen it, I have a feeling our F1.4 primes have it.
Oh, that might be.
But I know the Nikon lenses don't, the standard lenses.
Okay.
So for those of us who don't have it written on the barrel of the lens, we have to either trick the autofocus into focusing on infinity or do things the hard way. I like to avoid the hard way if at all possible. So stars and the moon are all at infinity. So find the brightest thing in the sky, set your camera to use single point autofocus, put that single autofocus point over the brightest thing and pray. If you hear the beep beep that it's got focus, you're done. Don't touch anything. Go straight into the menus and turn autofocus off so that it won't try to focus again. And now don't touch anything. Don't zoom the lens. Don't move anything. Now you're good to go. If that doesn't work, try find a light source like a house or something as far away from you as possible, because infinity and 300 yards away aren't actually that different when it comes to camera focus.
right, so if there's
a house on the horizon, that will do fine.
Makes sense?
If that works, you're golden. Lock the focus, away you go. If that doesn't work, you have to do things the hard way. What that means is you find the brightest thing in the sky, point your camera on it while it's on the tripod, take a photo, zoom in on the screen 100%, see how big the circle the star makes is. Move your focus in one direction or the other you choose. Repeat the process and see whether the circle has gotten bigger or smaller. If it's gotten smaller, you're turning the focus ring the right way. Keep going. If it got bigger, turn the focus ring the other way. Keep doing that until you get the circle as small as it can possibly be. Then you're in focus.
Okay.
That's horrible. You don't want to do that unless you have to, right?
Right.
I've always managed to trick... There's a neighbor of ours who always leaves the front door light on, and they're just far enough away that I get away with it. So if all else fails, Mrs. Brogan, thank you very much, your front door light is where I focus my camera on.
Yeah, maybe I missed part of what you said, but what I remember doing when I was trying to take pictures of the moon and getting it to autofocus was a bit problematic, especially since Steve had turned on off autofocus without telling me. But anyway, we won't keep bringing that up for more than 4 or 5 more years. But what I did was I did it to autofocus on something real far away, and then I turned the switch off on autofocus. So it would just stop trying, and I assumed it would stay where it was. Is that dumb?
No, that's not dumb, assuming you have a lens with a switch.
Okay. Ah, okay. Well, evidently I have a lens with a switch and software.
Yeah, the software switch will always be there. But in the case of the standard Nikon lenses, there is a hardware switch, and that will overwrite whatever the software does. Our Nifty 50s, the 30mm primes, do not have a hardware switch. So if you're using that, you have to do it in software.
Okay. All right.
Okay, now you're good to go.
Okay.
So you compose your shot. You have your ISO set low, remember. You compose your shot, and you just start taking a shot. Now, the key point here is that bits are free. So it's not like the days when you were paying for film. What you're going to do here is you're going to take infinitely more shots than you need, and then you're going to take them home, and in the warmth and comfort of your home afterwards, you're going to bin 99% of them and keep the ones that are right. So what I do is I start off with the ISO low, and then I take a 1 second shot, a 2 second shot, a 5 second shot, an 8 second shot, a 10 second shot, a 12 second shot, 15, 20, 25, and 30.
Oh, wow.
Then I have a good look at them all, and then I see at what point, when I zoom into 100%, do the stars become horribly egg-shaped. And then I dial back from that. So if the stars become horribly egg-shaped at 20, I'll dial back to 15 and consider that to be my ideal, and I just won't bother going as high as 30 in the future. But depending on where the stars are in the sky, that's going to change, because the stars are on a big sphere that's spinning, so anything that's near the poles, be it the South Pole or the North Pole, depending on whether you're Alistair Jenks down in New Zealand or me in Ireland, anything that's close to my North Pole or Alistair's South Pole moves a lot slower than anything near the celestial horizon.
Hmm.
So constellations like Orion that are at the celestial horizon, they move a lot faster than the Plough or the Southern Cross. Sorry, the Big Dipper to Americans, or the Southern Cross.
Hmm.
So there's no actual right answer. You can set up at 18 millimeters and the answer will be different depending on where in the sky you're looking. So trial and error is your only answer here.
So
you do that at your low
ISO. Are you able to see very well? Looks like we're lagging again. That's nice. Are you able to see in the viewfinder which of these exposure times is working at all? Or are you having to do all of these exposure times for every photo, again, bringing back to barting your photos when you get back to the house?
No, you can look on the back. So you use the LCD display on the back of the screen. And you zoom into 100% on a star, and that'll give you a good idea what's going on.
Okay, so you can narrow it down.
As your exposures get too long, So for the first one, you just spray a big range, and then you narrow down your range. But I still think it's important, don't only shoot at your one value, shoot above and below it, because what you think in the field may differ when you get home. So I like to keep it to a bracket of about 5, around my ideal. Okay. And then I start changing the ISO. I'm just ramping it up and ramping it up and ramping it up, and I keep ramping it up until the noise gets intolerably bad, and then I stop. And so for every shot I frame up, I'll fire off about 50 shots, varying the ISO and varying the exposure so that I have a nice broad range of things to choose from when I get home. The other thing to say is that don't worry about noise too much, because for not too much money, you can buy a noise reduction program. And a black sky is about as easy a thing to pull noise out of as you can possibly get, because it doesn't have any texture to lose. It's just a black sky.
Right.
I will and have. In fact, some of the sample images that I have in the post, I have shot at 6400 ISO and stuff like that. So you can really go mad and just pull the noise out later. So basically, that's all there is to taking the picture. The other thing I will say, though, it's not quite all there is to taking the picture. The next thing I just want to mention about is some thoughts on composition. Because to get a good night shot, you do actually have to worry about that. The first thing I'll say is, for this kind of stuff, stars are just little dots. They're not going to be very big dots. So if you just point the camera into some random part of sky and take a photo, you're not going to have a very eye-catching image. In fact, on a Flickr thumbnail, it will look like you've done nothing. It'll just look pure black. So what you need to do is you need to include some part of the terrestrial world into your composition. It doesn't have to be a lot. A little bit of horizon, a little bit of a tree, a few tree branches, the side of a building, something to anchor us back to the Earth and to put some context around what we're looking at. And then when you see the thumbnail on Flickr, you'll see sky and something around the sky, and then people say, oh, there's actually a photo here. They didn't just upload a blank thing.
Oh.
So there's an example in the show notes which has literally the tiniest sliver of horizon and like about a third of a tree. But that's enough. It doesn't take a lot just to anchor you down. The lower your target is to the horizon, the more fun you can have. So one of the examples I have is the Big Dipper with trees basically completely framing it.
So
you have the horizon frame
beautiful.
At the bottom, one tree for the left, one tree for the right. Yeah, so timing is good. If you can get your stuff as it's rising, you're going to have the most fun. The one thing to say, the stars are at infinite distance and you can't move them. So if you want to get a good composition, the only thing you can move is you. So you're going to be doing a lot of walking. A red torch is a very good idea, or you may do a lot of falling, which isn't so good. And the other thing, because the stars are constantly moving, your perfect composition won't stay perfect for very long. You have about 5 minutes usually. So don't dawdle. You know, get set up. Start taking your shots. Fire. Just click through your settings, Worry about the details later. Once you know the range that you're going through because you've done your test shots, fire. Move on.
You know, Bart,
sort out
this
the chaff
sounds,
when you get home.
This sounds stupid, but it doesn't seem to me like the stars move that fast. I guess I've just never tried to take pictures of them like that to notice.
I was going to say the difference depends on how picky you are about your composition. But I will notice that when I take a bracket of, you know, say 20 images as I vary the ISO and vary the exposure, you know, 20 or 30 images, in that time, they will have moved enough that as you're, if you stick them into aperture and you jump from your first one to your last one, you'll be surprised.
Okay.
And of course, the more you zoom in. So if you're working at 18 millimeters, they'll be slow. If you're working at 30 millimeters, they'll be a bit quicker. If you stick your 200 millimeter zoom on, they'll move staggeringly fast.
Okay.
So the next step in the process is obviously the post-processing. So the first thing you'll do is you'll look through all of your images and it'll be very easy to throw out the junk. Because the ones that are horribly overexposed, you'll have, oh, look, I have lines instead of dots, bin. The ones that are horribly underexposed is, oh, look, I see very, very little here, bin. And the sweet spot will stand out from the thumbnails very easily. It'll be the point where you have as much detail as you can while still having dots instead of lines. And it'll be very easy to take your 30 shots down to one. Or maybe two or three if you're don't find it easy to come to a decision. But you'll actually find it very easy to pick the right answer. So then the thing is, how do I make this look its best? And that's... I don't really want to prescribe to people this is a step of things to do. But I can tell you some things I found helpful. So the first thing I found is that in general, what you want is to exaggerate the contrast so that the stars are more obvious. So you want the sky to be darker and the stars to be brighter. Because if you've done a 10-second exposure even, the sky will not be black. It will be sort of, depending on how close you are to streetlights, it will be either a yellow or a blue color. And what you want to do is darken the sky, brighten the stars. So a curves adjustment is a great help a lot of the time. So you take the lower, you click a point somewhere near the bottom of the diagonal line that you start with, and you pull it down. And you take a point sort of a quarter away from the top and you pull it up. So you bring up the highlights and the midtones and you bring down the shadows. And that, you know, usually makes it look a lot better. The next thing you're probably going to have to contend with, unless you're lucky enough to live in the middle of nowhere, is you're going to have problems with light pollution. And the nice thing about light pollution, if there is such a thing, is that most of it is given off by streetlights, most of which are sodium. Therefore, they're all the same orange color. Therefore, most of that glow is sodium yellow, basically. I don't remember the exact wavelength, but it's pretty much all the same color. It's that orange glow. Ah. So what I do is I use the color brick in Aperture. I take an eyedropper, and I drop it onto a bit of orange. and then I take the luminosity to zero, and then I begin to desaturate until it looks reasonable. If you desaturate the whole way, your sky goes grey, which is not pleasant. So I usually desaturate about 50%, and that will have got the darkening will have gotten rid of the light pollution in most of your image. It'll leave a glow along the horizon, probably, which you'll then desaturate until it's a pleasant color. And that actually works kind of well, because that helps your silhouette that you're using to anchor yourself stand out. So it's sort of the best of both worlds. So that's what I do to deal with light pollution.
I'm afraid light pollution might be an awfully huge thing to deal with for us here. Oh, this lab is really fun, isn't it, Bart? I've actually stopped asking as many questions because it's so making me crazy. I want to know. There's so many things I want to ask you, but I'm going to let you just keep rolling, okay?
Well, save your questions till the end, and then we'll do them at the end.
Okay.
Okay, so the next obvious issue is you're going to run into noise. Because what's going to happen is you're going to take a photo at whatever the highest is that your camera can go without getting noisy, and it's going to be okay. But the one next to it in aperture is going to be the one you took at a higher ISO, and you're going to see more detail, and you're going to see more dim stars coming through. And yes, there's noise in there, but there's more stars. And you're not going to want to sacrifice the stars to save on the noise. And so the best thing you can do is just, okay, I'll accept the noise, and then I'll clean it out later. So for that, there are lots of options, but the one I use is Topaz Denoise, which is a plugin that will work in Aperture, Photoshop, Lightroom, even iPhoto. And it's not particularly expensive either. It's you can either get it as part of the Topaz bundle, or you can pick it up direct from Topaz. And of course, the link there's a link in the show notes. That's gone up in price since I bought it. Forget I said it wasn't very expensive. It's $80. It's just good value for money. Not cheap, but good. So Topaz Denoise will let you suck out a lot of that noise. Like, you can look at the demos on the Topaz site of just how good it can be if you use it right. One thing I will say, don't be tempted by the presets on the left-hand side. They're useless. Or rather, I'm sure they're really, really good if you have a photograph that exactly matches a particular stereotypical photograph. But reality is an awful lot more unquantized and a lot more sort of analog than that. So I just find that the only way to get good results is to take a little bit of time. There are free tutorials on the Topaz website and just learn to use the actual sliders. And then once you're good at it, you'll find that you'll clean up an image in about a minute. And the difference will be night and day. It will be a really spectacular difference. So that is the way I go. There's also Noise Ninja. There's a few of these.
So, at the risk of being able to actually ask a question. That was good. Yeah, you have to leave the gap. I'm actually coming in too early and you're coming in really late. So this is fun. So you've done all of this level of messing with the noise pollution, changing the, I think you said it was the saturation of the orange and doing the denoise on all of these photos that you've showed us?
Yes. That's all I've done on the ones I've shown you so far.
I don't know whether to leave the gaps in the audio recording because they won't understand why we're laughing so much if I don't leave these in. But this is it's like talking in the old days. Okay, Roger, out.
I was going to say it's like on the walkie-talkie. We need to say over. Anyway, so the other thing I just wanted to mention is what people tend to want on photographs of stars is those stereotypical, like you would see sort of in really nice photographs from observatories, the little star points around the star. They're technically called diffraction spikes, and ironically, they're actually a side effect of how we have to design large telescopes, because the secondary mirror in a telescope is unable to hover in midair and has to be held in place. So the struts that hold the secondary mirror in a telescope up cause diffraction spikes in the stars. And if you meet a particularly nerdy astronomer and you show them a photograph, they may be able to tell you which telescope took it based on the number of points on the stars and the orientation of the points. Because if you have a telescope with three arms holding up the secondary mirror, you'll get a six-pointed star. If you have one with four, you'll get the more traditional four-pointed star. and various other combinations. So if you want to get that same effect, you can do it in hardware or in software. If you do it in hardware, what you basically do is you take a little bit of string and you tie it across the front of your camera. I would suggest you sell a taper to the lens cap, not the lens. Sorry, the lens hood, not the lens. And you make a cross of thread across the top of your lens, and then you take your picture. And then you'll get the diffraction spikes, you know, the same way the telescopes get them. Or you can do it in post. And you can either use some Photoshop filters. I used to have a Photoshop brush that was a star shape, and I would use that because you only need the spikes on the very, very brightest of things. So if you're taking a picture of a planet or something, that needs spikes, but most stuff doesn't need a spike. So I would actually had a Photoshop brush that was a shape of one of those really nice stars, and I would just stamp it over the planet Venus in my photo. Ta-da! Spikes. But there's a much nicer option that came out about 3 days ago called Topaz Star Effects, which is a plugin from the Topaz people, and this one is cheap. It's currently available at a discount code. So its full price is $29.99, and from now until the middle of February, it's available for $10 off, so $19.99, which is a very reasonable price. And it will let you put in the spikes very, you know, very well. Actually, gives you a lot of control, different shapes of spikes, different intensities of spikes. So that's a lot of fun, that one.
That one looks like something that we ought to
finishing touches onto your image.
That one looks like something that we really ought to apply the "do ye all things in moderation" rule to. Though I can see how you could go crazy putting those things all over the place, guys. You know, pretty much like what's his name doing his solar flares on Star Trek, right? So my brother had a camera years ago that did that always. It was really cool because it wasn't an applied filter. It was simply, I don't know, something wrong with the camera that he had those star effects on basically every light. It was pretty funny.
It's not necessarily something wrong because our 30mm primes give a lovely star effect if the light is bright enough. But I found that on stars, it just isn't bright enough. I've got really beautiful stars out of train headlamps, but not out of stars, unfortunately.
Hmm.
Oh, over.
All right, why don't you...
That's my show notes at an end, so...
Oh, this is gruesome. Four restarts, three restarts, I think, so far, Skype, and we're still stopping on each other. Let me go ahead and try to do my closeout, and then from there, you will do the rest of the closing out, okay, Bart? So I really appreciate this. I'm going to go back and read the show notes, and Bart has given a link over to his blog at bartbouchats.ie, and I think it's really worth going through those in detail and looking at his photographs to see exactly what he's talking about. Thanks for the thanks for all the work, Bart.
Yeah, you're welcome, Allison. Whatever is causing this bug, I really hope it goes away by 2 weeks from now. Because in all the years of recording the show, we've never had one this difficult to record. Bart B. That IE works as well, by the way. So any link to bartbouchats.ie, if you take out the ooshots, it still works because the domains redirect to each other. That's it from me. So I think I'm supposed to say, until next time, happy computing.
All right. Well, that's about the worst Skype call I think we've ever had. I hope that never happens again. That was absolutely annoying and probably annoying to listen to as well. But what else are we going to do? Got to come out with the show. And what a whirlwind week this was. I want to give a big shout out to Steve for getting the videos encoded of our interviews so quickly, pulling the audio out so it'll be in the podcast as well. I know it was a lot of work to bang all of these out and do all this week's worth of chores in a single day coming home from Macworld. Many thanks to our sponsors for helping to pay the bills, ScreenSteps, and Smile. Don't forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com. Follow me on Twitter at podfeet. I contribute a lot over on Google+, and plus there's a whole Google Hangout thing, so just search for me by name over there if you want to circle me up. If you want to join in the fun of the live show, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic Nosilla Castaways. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.